It was so the old dual aluminum, which was the airship and let's say First World War champion young in aluminums, being 20% below 2014. That got more or less out of fashion.
Yeah.
That got out of fashion. But the Alcoa development, redevelopment of that alloy, yielded a combined heat treatment, a combined treatment. That was the overlap of heat treatment with a cold work. That means you had to stretch. You know why the 5000 series and also the, why the 5000 series got only stronger and harder by cold working it, maybe stretching it 10%. And it didn't react to any heat treatment and fast chilling. The copper-containing alloys, they reacted to the heat treatment in order to harden or soften. Now the combination of that, and that was really the major discovery, namely that you stretch the 2019, the 6% copper alloy, you stretch it 10%, and then you heat treat it. That increased the strength by 20%, and that brought this 2219 alloy exactly into the competitive range to 2014. So that was really the big technological breakthrough to have a double treatment, which also naturally now makes it a little harder to work with the material. But it is better weldable.
There was a controversy, as I recall, or at least some discussion about the difference between TIG welding and MIG welding. In Douglas, could you comment about that a little bit? They wanted to keep on using the MIG weld, as I recall, and you couldn't see why they just couldn't go ahead with some TIG welding, especially on the S4B.
Yeah, the reason or the underlying reason is that the Douglas design and mode of operation is conservative. They maintained in their S4B welding and their whole S4B structural mode, basically the Thor technology. Mm-hmm. And they did all the welding downhand. That means whenever they welded something, they put it down in into horizontal position. Mm-hmm. They didn't weld in place. And so the weld puddle, by gravity, just was running its way, and you could make very thick welds, for instance, in one pass, in order to fill the big gaps also at thicker materials. They got a higher degree of annealing, but also their structural approach was just to use the weld with 20% of their carrying capability. So they were very conservative in their engineering requirements. They were very conservative in their tooling approach by welding everything downhand. And they didn't proceed to butt welds so that they could live with a relatively primitive or with this conventional modes. They also used, for instance, circular bulkheads, which are not weight optimum. You know, for a pressure vessel, the end closure, if that is a hemisphere, that would be the lightest bulkhead you can build, because the spherical tank needs only half the wall thickness of the cylinder wall. Mm-hmm. It's just a basic law, you know. So now, But whenever you connect now this to some other portion of the vehicle, you have to put up a skirt here. And this skirt length is naturally also a little longer than the radius of that sphere, so that you can continue with the instrument unit and so on. So the total weight concentration for that end is the bulkhead weight plus the skirt weight. Mm-hmm. And there you find out, whenever you make an elliptical bulkhead, which is only 70% high, which is the ellipse 1 over root 2 ratio, this long versus the small radius, then this ellipse gets a little bit thicker in wall, but your skirt gets 30% shorter. And because the pressure vessel gauges are determined by the inside pressure and are more or less not that demanding in wall, while the longitudinal force transmission, you know, really puts the weight into the skirts. The major weight loss is actually in the unpressurized skirt structures and in the sponge spring skirt structures. This is where hundreds of thousands of pounds are. You know, you optimize your structure by going to elliptical bulkhead. And that was one of my structural development things, together with industry research and so on, to figure out what is the optimum end, tank end, plus skirt. So in all the vehicles in the S2 stage and in our S1, and we introduced it in our S1C stage, we proceeded to elliptical bulkheads with 1 over root 2 or 70% radius proportion. Mm-hmm. Which needs a little bit more tooling to make the bulkhead. But after the bulkheads are so big, you even mightn't have known that this is not a hemisphere.
Yeah.
But it is a very essential weight saving. It's a much more essential approach, and everybody does it now. You know, the S2 stage does it as well. Mm-hmm. But Douglas stuck to the, even knowing that, they stuck in their proposal to the hemispherical bulkheads. And also their common dome in there has the same radius, so that they would use one tool set for making the bulkhead.
Yeah.
That, you know, so from that, say, simplicity and cost effectiveness reasons, or from conventional playing it safe reasons with high safety factors, and with using hemispherical bulkheads, you know, they some way got that contact. Because, I mean, they were not too much cheaper, but they played it safe and some way made it. But these are the weaknesses of that stage. The stage is not optimum. It has an optimum material, but it is not utilized in any way, not in the configuration and not in the weight chunks.
Is part of that, though, because the S4 and the S4B stage were kind of the first of the major Saturn structures. I mean, they were the first.
Which we contracted out.
Yeah,
uh-huh. You know.
So that Douglas, in a sense, was at the beginning of the technological ladder, and the S2 and the S1C.
They continued the let's say the redstone tubular technology, which they had picked up in the Thor structure, and they continued that consequently, and they cost optimized this. They made a large technological contribution in the inside insulation of the tank, because the hydrogen was a novelty, you know. They had also naturally in their common dome a lot of troubles because of that relatively unsound structural approach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was, in effect, you know, this tank in here sits in the other tank body. And this joint here, that was a trouble area which has cost many, many millions to rectify it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still a very weak spot. There is no vehicle which doesn't have their certain deficiencies in there.
Hmm.
I mean, meanwhile, we are used now that it performs, but any time that could be a major catastrophe for stage explosion.
Hmm.
I mean, I don't want to mislead you. I mean, nothing is perfect.
Yeah.
But this was one area, you know, where a lot of improvement had to be introduced even to make it acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
with Doppler funding, and we have spent many, many millions here on our lab with Douglas and others in order to improve the technology.
Is the North American common bulkhead with the J-ring coming down and the hydrogen tank sitting in there, is that a different configuration?
Absolutely. You know, because when then the S2 stage was going out for open bid, North American was doing the following. They said 2014 is superior in strength to weight ratio to any other material at that time. Secondly, Douglas, our competition, uses it and successfully welds it. Their design people in North America said, okay, if Douglas can weld that material, then we, in any case, can do as well or even not better, and they progressed in their configuration from lap joints to butt joints with that material, which turned out later to be a major cost-consuming item. Because then they had to, we with them together finally, had to solve the unsolvable problem of making the higher demanding grade joint. Also, their stress people said, if Douglas has a 80% safety margin in their weld in order to tolerate all type of small deficiencies in that ticklish material, they moved that up to 50% safety factor. So their welding result was at the same time towards higher requirement. So they had to tool better, they had to, and that really was the big obstacle, you know, and the delay in the S2 stage production because of the optimistic, let's say, the design idea, if Douglas can do it, we can do better, you know, and they didn't really know what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. Because at that time, the aircraft companies never welded aluminum anyway. They had a small drone which was once welded in 2014, and that was, I think, 20 inch in diameter. What was that? I might remember the name later. And so, I mean, the what happened is the extrapolation of the structural experience, especially in aluminum welding, from the 30 inch Bormark tank to the S1C 33 foot tank, and in North American from their 16-inch weapon system, you know, to the 33-foot stage, that naturally caused a lot of pitfalls, which in technology judgment, which later had to be evened out, that was really the major learning. But otherwise, the S2 stage used completely the structural principle of the S1Z stage, I mean the elliptical bulkheads, the type of stiffness, longitudinal T-stiffness, instead of the old waffle pattern. And I figured that out here also personally. It sounds a little bit funny, but this is not 10 years. You know, I'm an aircraft designer and test pilot. I'm trained in optimization of structures. And when I converted after the war, or coming to the States, really to right field, but they said we don't have too much work, but there is the missile thing going up in New Mexico. If you go there, you can sit there for 1 year and adjust to the foot pound system, and they have nothing to do anyway, which was the Air Force mode of operation. They had their own missile development center, but the STL did everything, made decision for the Titan and so on. We didn't even get the reports. So it was all done by the Air Force subcontractors. That was their mode of operation. So after 1 year, I left there and went here. But the missile designers were not familiar with aircraft and lightweight structure. Mm-hmm. And in fact, by Dr. von Braun and other leading people, the structural efficiency wasn't considered to be very important. And in truth, it isn't. our the development was in first place the development of the engine, that they worked and had produced enough thrust,
mm-hmm.
and the guidance and control systems, that this thing didn't fall back on your head. You know, the plumbing in between, that was a plumber's job, and nobody cared about that, and that was not the first order of technology criterion.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came here, and the Redstone and the Jupiter and the Saturn One came about, and the vehicle payload performance was improved, it was always done by making the tanks longer.
Just add more fuel.
Yeah. Add more fuel and you get more total impulse. You know, it was really the lower efficient way, and was really not the most clever way to gain more payload by refining your basically crude
mm-hmm.
missile structure. That only comes about now with the space shuttle, where this thing has to fly as well.
Mm.
But as long as you're expendable, you know, the structural refinement requirement is not a first order requirement. This is actually the basic difference between aircraft and rocket technology, especially the technology of expendable rockets. And all our weight improvement justifications that, you know, when I came here and I saw they were building their plumbing tin cans and with no regard to basic refined lightweight structural technology, which was already very well known from aircraft development. You know, first you think they are stupid, then you find out they are not so stupid after all. That is just the law, the difference between aircraft and missiles.
It's a trade-off situation.
You know, the trade-off, mm-hmm. and it is not too clever, you know, to gold-plate something which you don't have to gold-plate.
Mm-hmm.
And the emphasis, you know, on engines and on guidance and control systems finally led to the perfection. So since about 5 years, you can buy a guidance and control system maybe through industry catalogs. I mean, Sears doesn't deal yet with guidance and control systems, but they will as soon as the demand increases. So, I mean, this guidance and control miracle. Technology-wise, it was solved around 90. At least it was solved in the 70s. It was solved already in 1965.
Mm.
To the perfection of reliability, of lifetime, to be operational for maybe a couple of years, even for a Mars mission and so on, which was thought to be impossible 20 years earlier. And the engine technology, which also was in the beginning just a 3 minute affair, and you were happy if it ran 3 minutes, and after that it was dumped anyway in the ocean. You know, that was extended, especially through the S3D engine, namely the Rocketdyne warehouse, which is the Saturn One, you know, we called it the Rocketdyne warehouse because it had 5 Rocketdyne engines on it. And
you called it the
Rocketdyne warehouse. It was the Rocketdyne engine, 5 there, it was a warehouse for engines. And they loved it, you know, because it was big business.
Yeah.
Rocket and aircraft technology. And because I came from one side and penetrated into the other and had luck to participate in the essential rocket developments.
Mm-hmm.
I can see pretty clearly, or what I really are doing is working out the crossbreed. That means after the engine and guidance technology is more or less over the hump, the next step was to optimize the structural technologies.
So the structural technologies are still catching up in a sense.
And this is now the major problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the space shuttle recovery. That means you have to learn how to build a pressure vessel. Let me say that the major portion of a missile structure or a rocket structure is the tank.
Mm-hmm.
the major portion of the aircraft structure are the wings.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to build a crossbreed, you have to get the wing requirement or the aerodynamic requirement together with the pressure metal requirement. And that is exactly, you know, the development work which I started then in the 60s. And that was the development of multi-cell tanks or intersecting pressure metals. Because there is one beautiful natural law, and this is now the baseline for the shuttle technology. That means whether you pack a certain liquid into one pressure vessel or in a number of smaller ones, the weight of the shell is constant. That's a natural law. That means...
Would that be true for the Saturn One as well?
Yeah. It doesn't matter whether you cluster or whether you put it in one tank. That is no weight saving.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The weight saving is only indirect.
With the spider beams. And
no, whatever. But the real clue is, you know, that is even because the wall thickness depends on the radius. I mean the pressure naturally, but the radius is directly proportional to the wall thickness. That means if you make the radius smaller, the wall thickness is smaller, and then the shell weight is constant.
Mm-hmm.
That is even true whenever you intersect the pressure vessels. If you intersect pressure vessels, where they intersect, you get a straight retaining wall. You know, and you get this multicellular structure, which are used by Pittsburgh and mine for building big pressure vessels. You know, you have seen the scallop tanks.
Mm.
Now the scallop tank, and so the intersecting pressure vessel technology together with the aerodynamic requirements, that gives you the crossbreed. That means for no weight loss in your structural shaping, you can build a full pressurized structure to your other demands.
Aerodynamic demand,
yeah.
Shape.
Yeah, which ends up in
right,
in
right
something
here.
Like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is then an old-fashioned rocket, which has multi-cell fuel tank, multi-cell LOX tanks, which has then parallel tanks instead of stacked-up tanks with the big suction lines penetrating. You know, we had the upper tank, the lower tank, the suction lines going through the tank, which is really a pain in the neck weight-wise. Here you have short suction lines, you have a simple thrust structure, you know. But this is a crude, maybe steel tank rocket.
Mm-hmm.
This is for the rocket builder.
Mm-hmm.
Then, where the gimbal points are, you have the main spar, you attach your main spar of your wings. Now, the wings, this is aircraft structure with a retractive landing gear. And then you have your engine package, which you retract in here, which is another interface package. And that together, that makes a reusable rocket.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is with four F1 engines.
Mm-hmm.
That's good enough for the shuttle. That is, this is with F1 and Lux kerosene. You can see if you take hydrogen engines, you know, the major missile people are propulsion people, because propulsion was the major development area, or guidance and control people.
Mm-hmm.
There were not many structural people involved, because everybody could do it. Now, making that an aircraft, it's different. If you, from a propulsion point of view, decide for the best engine, and the best engine with the best specific impulse is a hydrogen-fired engine,
mm-hmm.
you know, then you build such a big vehicle because hydrogen needs 2.5 to 3 times the storage volume. It's so light. And this is the size of the booster, and this is the size of the orbiter, just to get the hydrogen in there. But if you use the fuel, the kerosene, you know, which is 20 times denser than the hydrogen and the LOX, then your tank gets so small and your booster gets that small for the same size. That means, while here the specific impulse of the LOX fuel engine is maybe 30% lower versus the hydrogen engine,
mm-hmm.
your structure is only half as big, and your structural savings and the total operational behavior overrides by far the selection of the propulsion system from a specific impulse point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So if you see the whole thing, that's what you get. And but, what really happens is there's now a big turnaround towards that system.
Okay, I was going to ask you, because all the pictures and models I've seen are more this huge thing here rather than the lighter one, but they're coming around to this now, finally, the smaller RP one.
Since 2 years, this is 2 years old, but now it's reinvented by everybody. The biggest thing is now the introduction.
But, but I mean, they are not yet that far.
You know, we don't put up any configuration. You know, I mean, we are a government agency.
Yeah.
And we should just do the impossible, and industry does the possible, and we shouldn't really do the work of industry. So we shouldn't really, you know, so the mode of operation is to wait until you get the responses. You only fertilize the ideas by giving them everything you know what we constantly do, until they get around to something which is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And this iteration in the space shuttle is going on over the last couple of years. We have spent $30 billion just in the educational program. which is the purpose of the NASA program. I mean, what for? I mean, we are not building the vehicles just to play with them. I mean, this is workload and technology development reasons. So it's like a big monastery, you know, where you have really nothing to accomplish. You pray three times a day, and now we pray in Washington, you know. It's the same thing like sitting in a middle-aged monastery and inventing the black powder because you have nothing else to do in between praying. So that's the machines do the work, you know, produce, and people just have to lift it up some way. And after it's not satisfactory to just consume, it's more satisfactory to create. It's harder for the Jews to just consume gasoline and car tires. You know, it's easier to peel potatoes all day and say, I did my day's work and now I eat and pray. You are more satisfied from that. That's really the underlying crisis. So, I mean, we have to create a program which has a large creative challenge and spread it out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we are doing. So if you say that's the way to go, that's the old generation way to go. You have to go through all thinkable configurations and do it the hard way. Because if you don't do it the hard way, you're not learning anything. And so this is the balance we have to find. You know, if we would say, just tell us we can build a booster, it's very similar to that one. You know, we might have another SST program. It might even not be completed. But if you build up a national program for $20 billion, the effort is not bigger as to get $20 million. So you have to go out for a bigger package, which is much larger and much longer. If you get that through, it's more efficient as if you do it in piecemeal. And I mean, this is the way we have to look at the total thing, you know. We have to think big. And not just think in certain specific practical solutions. And if something is done the wrong way, that is really stimulating technology, because there was once a draftsman here in the States, he didn't know that the holes are round, so he put square holes in his drawing. Then the manufacturing technologists developed machines to make square holes, even in full hard material, you know, with electron machines. So that was maybe the stupid portion of it. But the next generation engineers are using now the square hole in a very refined mode. And we have a big instrument suddenly in our head. And learning is only possible by doing something wrong. Otherwise, you know it already, you don't learn anything. So, I mean, just, you know, let the challenge and the solution overwhelm your capability for a while, and then the next generations of engineers and scientists, they have enough reason to be creative and solve the problems.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have a weapon system development program where we have to fill a need. We have a technology development program where the space objective is only one of the reasons to develop the problem. And the problems must be very demanding with respect to the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And it must keep a whole nation busy. So, I mean, this is philosophy, but I mean, this is where you get to, because it sounds pretty funny that I say we would know how to do it, and why the hell is there nobody doing it? We don't have to save money on the booster. You know, we rather want to spend it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that thing is too simple, just go ahead, do it a little bit more complicated.